Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Bill Blaine. Bill is a published author on financial markets, contributor and editor of The Morning Portage. He's an investment banker in the alternative private debt and equity sector with Shard Capital. He's got over 36 years career in global markets as experience, very unique. It includes senior level roles as head of financial institutions and debt capital markets at leading investment firms, plus spells as a financial market journalist. Firms on his CV include Morgan Stanley, Bear Stearns, HSBC, and BGC. Welcome, Bill.
Hi.
Great. I thought we'd begin with a macro view discussion on your thoughts on the global economy and the financial markets.
Yeah, that's a big topic. I mean, where is the global economy going? Are we going to come out of the pandemic? Well, it certainly looks that way. Does that mean a recovery? Well, you would have thought so. But the big bogey there is inflation, and especially as we're immediately seeing energy price inflation. So we've got a really interesting situation in the UK where the BBC is now describing it as a cost of living crisis. This month, people are going to get energy bills that are up £700 over the course of a year, which is very significant. For most UK families, it's not something that's easily afforded. So it's going to cut discretionary spending. And we also have on the horizon, I think, a really frightening increase in food prices coming. Now, everyone says, Bill, how can there possibly be a food price inflation crisis? Well, you look at the price of gas, which has gone up 400% over the last year. With taking out spikes and volatility. Well, one of the other key commodities that is going to go up in price is fertilizers. Fertilizers depend on the plants being up and running to make the stuff, and it's just not been happening. So you've seen fertilizer prices go through the roof. And when you have a global economy that is going into recovery but is still suffering from a surface of supply chain problems, which normally would be fixed fairly quickly. Even last year we saw the price of wood accelerated greatly, and then it came back down very quickly once the immediate supply block was changed. But we've still got China effectively closed, so the supply chain problems will continue. Plus, you've got this massive inflation going on. And I think there is still a very serious risk of what we call stagflation, where you actually have the expected recovery turning into a downturn, even as we get massive inflation occurring. And I certainly think it's going to happen in the UK. It's going to be really interesting to see what happens in Europe. Or if we do see a stagflationary environment, I think that's another nail in the European coffin.
What drivers do you see of a stagflationary environment?
Well, the drivers I just discussed there, where you have so many non-transitory inflation sources coming, not just from supply chains, but from energy insecurity, food insecurity, and the fact that wages are simply not going to catch up. We had the Bank of England warning workers not to demand wage hikes, and that is difficult for most workers. But already we're seeing in the public sector that many of the operatives there have been able to secure themselves big pay increases. So you've got wage push inflation going on in some parts, and that will inevitably result in the rest of the economy demanding wage hikes as well, which companies are going to struggle to deal with in a post-pandemic environment where so much of the economy remains, pretty weak. The doors may be open, we may be selling stuff again, the companies are dealing with 2 years of trying to reinvent themselves. So that's one set of things. Central banks are not using the expression transitory inflation anymore. So I think that sums up where they are, and they're desperate trying to play a game of how little can we do without upsetting the situation and making it worse.
And how do you see central bank policies, monetary policies, and fiscal policies factoring into this stagflationary environment?
Well, you know, you got to step back and look and have a think about what central banks have really been doing for the last 14 years since the global financial crisis that peaked in 2008. I mean, my own take, which I've said a number of times in my morning porridge, is that the global financial crisis 2007 to 2033 is only about halfway through. Because what we're going to see now is the unraveling of the first part of the extreme monetary experimentation that central banks went through from 2008. And that's when they cut interest rates to the bone. So we had unfeasibly low interest rates. The same time we had quantitative easing. At the same time, we also had a regulatory change in the market, effectively pushing risk out of the banking sector and moving it onto the investment sector. If you now take a look, none of the investment banks are making markets or anything like that. They're not taking risk positions. Their capital rules constrain them from doing so. And all the risk now resides in the investment management sector of the financial economy. So all these things have occurred, and they've caused enormous, dislocation in pricing. Because if interest rates are too low, you're not getting the return you require on bonds. So it forced what we call yield tourism, where people investing in bonds then had to go for a lower credit to get the kind of return they needed, which meant people stopped investing in AAA securities and started buying junk. And when the yields on junk became too low to justify the risk return equation, they started buying equities instead in pursuit of returns. And that's one of the reasons: cheap liquidity, cheap capital, interest rates too low. And that's what's fueled the massive, unbelievably strong bull market the last 12 years. Now, the game for central banks was to hope that they would be able to exit and normalize interest rates again in a strong and vibrant global economy, which they thought was going to happen post-pandemic, because the simple read was global economy's in trouble, it's going to recover, you'll have all that money that's been saved up in the banks by people not spending and they'll want to do it, so we'll have a discretionary spending boom, global economy will recover, we can raise interest rates, and we won't unstabilize the markets as we saw in the taper tantrum in 2014, whenever it was. That hasn't happened. We've now got all the consequences starting to appear in the market. If you take a look at the number of unprofitable companies, and that's companies that simply have never been profitable, that are in the major stock indices around the world, it's a higher number than we've ever seen before. We've got an awful lot of companies do have very high balance cash positions on their balance sheets. You know, some, you know, like Apple could go out and effectively buy the rest of the global economy with the cash they've got sitting. But many companies don't have that. And what they've done is they've leveraged themselves up through the crisis because interest rates were so low. And what have they done with the money they borrowed through their leveraging? Well, by and large, they spent it buying their own stock back, which is effectively replacing equity with debt. And when the value of that equity tumbles, that money's gone. And we're seeing that all across the global economy as well. So, you know, there's a whole series of distortions in financial markets that occurred because of ultra low interest rates, QE replacing, you know, central banks have become the buyers of last resort. They've replaced the banks who no longer make markets. And it's all held in the institutional management sector, which frankly doesn't care what the returns are for investors like you and me, because they're in the business of just milking fees from every single aspect of the business. So, you know, it's a very different financial market. Now, let's go back to what the bank, central bank policy would be in such a situation. It's still to try and normalize, and it's still to try and normalize without upsetting and causing a catastrophic market crash, which would further damage sentiment. They were hoping to get away from it in a recovery, but because of the way that inflation has galloped forward and how weak the global economy still looks because of supply chains, and then we've got all the additional costs that we're going to have to build in from the global energy transition for climate change, suddenly it's a really difficult picture. And I don't think they're going to get away with just simply getting interest rates back up to normal level. That's going to cause even more instability. And here's one of the really interesting things. We're beginning to see normalization coming back into the market. And that's happened in the UK, where the government's decided that to pay the costs of the pandemic, we're now going to hike interest rates and increase the most regressive form of taxation in the country, national insurance contributions, all to pay for the National Health Service, where it doesn't matter how much money you pump into the UK National Health Service, they will still go, feed me more, feed me more. But they're doing that at a time when the economy remains fundamentally weak. And if there's one thing we learned in the 2010s, it's that austerity is the worst possible way of trying to get an economy working again. So, you know, we're going to make all the same mistakes we've made before, but hey-ho, that's the way it goes.
And between rising interest rates and QT quantitative tightening, which one do you think are you more concerned about?
Well, you know, raising interest rates back to a normal level will get rid of many of the distortions, but the consequences of 12 years of ultra-low interest rates is that, well, just think about it. I mean, I was in our trading floor last week in London, and I'm looking around the trading floor, and there's a few old dogs like myself still hanging around, but most of our fund managers and traders are below 40. You know, they're very bright kids, but they've never worked in a market where interest rates have been normal, and they just assume this is the way it happens. So when interest rates start to rise, these guys are looking at us and say, what? Interest rates can go up and markets can come down? No, when did that happen? You know, and this is what's going to hit the whole meme stock generation. What? Stock markets go down as well as up? Fuck. I really can't say that on TV or radio, but I just did. There's a major change. So that's the first thing. I mean, quantitative easing, you know, it actually, you know, it raises a lot of interesting possibilities. Quantitative easing demonstrated that governments could effectively fund themselves. The great one in the UK again, because hey, that's where I am, and I understand the Bank of England. I reckon better than I understand any other central bank. In the morning, the Debt Management Office of the United Kingdom, which is an arm of the UK Treasury, it will issue 1 billion of gilts, that's government bonds in the UK. And the market would buy these gilts. And then the Bank of England would step in the afternoon and buy all these gilts back and put them onto their balance sheet. And they'd pay, you know, the Debt Management Office would issue them at par. 100. Sorry, let me just switch off. Sorry about that. The Debt Management Office would issue bonds at par, and then the Bank of England would buy them back at 100.01, something like that. So there was a small turn for the dealers. The Bank of England would then put them as an asset on their balance sheet, which would be recorded as a liability on the Treasury's balance sheet. And it suddenly occurred, and I think this is where an increasing number of economists have figured out, well, hang on, these are matching items on the country's balance sheet. Here you've got 1 billion, you've raised a billion, you've got a billion back, wipe it out, and you created free money effectively. which has always been the way that banks have worked. They create money the whole time, every time they make a loan, because they don't have $100 in their pockets to lend you $100. They have $10 in the till to lend you $100, therefore creating 90. So it's been a very interesting thing, quantitative easing. But what it has meant is that they are the market. And this is especially true in the corporate debt market, where the Bank of England and the ECB have supported, and the Fed as well, have supported bond prices through their quantitative easing bond buying purchases. And they've become the market. Banks don't make markets anymore. Sure, they'll post you a price, but there's no way they're going to buy the kind of size and bonds that central banks have. And again, over 12 years of doing that, you look around the trading floors and none of these kids know how to go and find a broker who's going to be able to provide the liquidity that they're going to need. Now, this is going to get fascinating when interest rates start to go up, because what happens when interest rates rise is that bond prices collapse and people will then try and sell their bonds. And if the central banks are no longer in their bond buying program mode, who's going to buy them? Well, nobody. It's going to be an absolutely locked shop market. And I just don't think that the market appreciates just how dangerous the corporate bond markets are. Now, I've spent my whole life in corporate bonds, and I know how illiquid they are. Most bond issues are tiny, they're not all fungible, meaning you can't simply trade one piece of forward debt for another piece of forward debt. They've all got different terms and maturities, and they're tremendously illiquid. And when the market goes offered only, as I think it will do when interest rates seriously start to rise, at that point, people are going to be left holding on to a whole bunch of paper. And that'll be particularly true in the junk bond market, where I think it's inevitable that after 12 years of all this interest rate distortion, meaning that corporate defaults were at their lowest ever level, suddenly you're going to see higher interest rates kicking off a whole lot of corporate defaults. And guess what happens? The whole junk bond market's going to experience the kind of defaults that we haven't seen ever. So it's going to be fascinating to see how this all unravels. There is always the chance that it might not happen as violently as I suspect, that we do manage to get interest rates normalizing and the market getting some form of stability. But if central banks stop their bond buying programs, then fundamentally, we're going to have to find a new way of making markets in bonds. Fortunately, I've got some ideas on that, you know, but probably a bit away from working. So as a fallback, I always stick to one of my key mantras. I do have a number of market mantras. I can never remember them all. I've got them listed somewhere. But number three on that list says, things are never as bad as you fear, but seldom as good as you hope. So even though I'm pointing out the risks of chronic illiquidity in a bond market crash, it might not be as bad as you think. Even in 2008, we were able to make markets in, you know, really bad bonds, and we got away with it. So you know what? The market's more resilient than maybe we think.
Mm-hmm. And how do you see the implications of this rolling out in terms of, say, from the European bond market? Would there be capital flows going into equities or U.S. equities or precious metals, cryptocurrencies?
Okay, there's a whole lot of topics there, but let's start off with the effect of far too low interest rates and easily available cash driving speculation. It's when cash is plentiful and cheap that you start to look at the risk reward of any investment, and you come to the conclusion because money is cheap, the risks are worth taking because money is so cheap. So it drives phases of speculation. And this has been one of the most speculative phases in financial history, going all the way back to the original grain shortage in the Roman Empire days. You know, where you had a glut of grain followed by drought causing enormous inflation problems, and because the amount of money that was getting spent on the legions and stuff. But it brings us back today where you have a very speculative market, and that fuels ideas, and ideas attract cash if they're good ideas. And we've seen it in cycles. The last one ended in 2000 with the dot-com crash, because everyone thought that this newfangled thing called the internet, which you of course know so well, was going to completely change the way that we did everything and bought everything. So you ended up with a pet food company valued in trillions or whatever it was then, because everyone thought it was going to happen. Now, the same thing's happened in the last few years with tech. Everyone's looked at any kind of idea and they thought, that's brilliant. That's going to change the world. It's going to be disruptive. And I have a kind of an idiot's index of overvalued tech. It's a thing called ARK. And fortunately, I found a woman called Kathy Wood who runs it, because it's the great fund investing in all these wonderfully disruptive ideas, which, you know, look and sound fantastic. But the problem is they don't make any money, nor are they ever likely to do so in a lot of cases. And then you look at the SPAC market, which is, again, largely fueled by this speculation. And there was one deal, I'm not sure if it actually happened, but it was a guy who was proposing to launch tugs into space, which would drag satellites up to a higher orbit. And, you know, it was valued at $600 million, this idea, in a SPAC. But you know what? You can do that already by putting a slightly bigger motor on the rocket with more fuel. And these things, speculation gets carried away. The buzz behind a concept like disruptive tech gets taken away. And people then start to forget the basic rules of business, which is, if you've got a great business idea, people are going to spot it and they're going to compete for your space. And that's why it's been so interesting this week when we saw Meta, as it's now called, getting spanked. Because guess what? Mark Zuckerberg made a fundamental error. He admitted the truth. He didn't lie. He admitted that TikTok is eating its lunch. So effectively, it's being replaced in its social media space that it dominated, with people like you and I, because I got my first Facebook account years ago, but I'm about the average age now of the users. So it's just not relevant. My kids certainly don't use it. And then the second issue he admitted was, oh, and guess what? Our advertising revenue is falling because people like Apple have made it difficult to get the data that we lived off. And you know what? Regulators are going to insist on privacy. So our whole business model's failed. We're losing our market share. Our moat is not very wide or deep. And so I bet the shop that you'll all want to buy non-fungible tokens in the meta space. And so Facebook is a great example of, you know, an idea that's probably matured and is now being overtaken by nimbler competition. And it's going to move itself into a completely speculative market, which is populated by stuff like, you know, brilliant, let's go gaming. But I, for one, I'm never going to spend £3 billion or $3 billion buying a Bored Ape Yacht Club NFT, non-fungible token, because you know what? I'm not in my own flat today, but back in my house in England, I have got some fantastic real artwork on the walls, and I don't need to store it on some hackable computer. And you asked about, you know, that speculation, I think, has also underlain and been magnified by very powerful social forces like FOMO. Now, FOMO is one of the strongest financial forces in the world, fear of missing out. And I think that's one of the major factors that tends to drive the behavior of crowds. And the market, of course, is nothing but an enormous voting machine that reflects that behavior of crowds. So if you have an asset traded by a tiny number of people, let's say, call it Bitcoin, and it goes up and down and then goes up and up and up and up, it attracts lots of other people attracted by FOMO. And I find it incredible, some of the debates that I have with some of the younger people in the office and outside finance about Bitcoin, how it can only possibly go up. Well, you know what, they're waking up to the reality of, you know, that these things are all based on speculation. Now, I'm not going to argue whether Bitcoin, because I know you're a fan of crypto, I'm not going to argue about whether cryptocurrencies are real or not, or what their intrinsic value is. I mean, I'm quite happy with the pounds and dollars and dirhams I've got in my wallet at the moment, and I'll stick with them. You know, people get attracted to these things because of FOMO and because they're speculative. And this is part of the wake up and smell the coffee moment that is coming. Mm-hmm. So if you take a look at tech, people are now going back and fundamentally reassessing value. So what they're looking at is, what kind of profitability has this company got? What kind of management have they got in place to deliver that? What are their competitive, what is their competitive moat? How secure are they? Now, one of the companies I've been calling out as a massive overvalued sell has been Tesla. And I've been doing that for years, saying this company is fundamentally overvalued. I've gone from doubting that Facebook would survive, not Facebook, Tesla would survive about 5 years ago. I doubted it would survive because it just was never meeting its targets. And I'm now, having driven one, I'm being quite impressed. I've now come to the conclusion they're actually an okay car company. They are definitely leading the electric vehicle market, and they are beginning to produce cars that in maybe 10 years' time, they will be one of the largest auto firms on the planet. Absolutely excellent. But that doesn't justify its valuation. Even if Tesla becomes number one car company in the world, let's say that it's worth, because of its leadership in the EV space, let's say it's worth 50% more than Toyota. That only values it somewhere in the region of $400 billion. So that is about a $600 billion drop, 60% drop in its current share price to properly reflect a really good company. So why is it that it's worth so much? Well, it's because of FOMO and speculation, but it's also because of the narrative that goes around Tesla. People really do buy into this idea that everyone's going to build and buy electric cars. But there are problems there because, you know what? We're running out of lithium. Just take a look at the price of lithium this year. The price of electric cars is going to have to rise to reflect the scarcity of lithium. And in the next few years, electric vehicles, unless we find a successor to lithium, are simply not going to be practical because of the difficulties extracting the element and the price it's going to cost. So there's a limit. You know, people always say, hey, that's what we all thought about gas, oil and petrol, that we'd run out, and we never have. There's always more. Yeah, probably there is always more lithium, but lithium's got its problems. You know, it's intensely dirty to mine it. And whatever Elon Musk is telling you, it's almost impossible to recycle. Nobody's really done that yet. But let's just leave the lithium thing just now. One of the other reasons I'm told that Tesla is such a great company is the value of its driverless cars. Well, hang on, we've been waiting for full self-drive for years, and Tesla makes a lot of money selling the updates to FSD that it still hasn't delivered. And if full self-driving is going to work, it's going to have to work on every single car. Every single car will have to be full self-driving all the time, because you cannot, experience tells us you cannot have human actors and AIs working together, because you can't predict what a human's going to do. We can't even make trains run on a track in the UK without them being late and delayed. So I just don't see full service driving happening unless we get a massive change. And what's really interesting with full service driving is the potential legal implications. Here in the UK, it's recently been decided by the Law Commission that if a car is in full self-drive mode, then it's not the driver who's going to be liable. It will be the manufacturer that is liable. I just think that through for a moment in terms of what that means for the cost implications on any manufacturer of any accident that an FSD car has, you know, especially in the States where you've got potentially unlimited damages if someone's killed by one of these things, as we have already seen. So I think full self-drive is years away. It's not months away, as people think. Now, the reason I bring these up is if you are making an investment in a complex technology firm like Netflix or Tesla or even Amazon, you need to actually think about all these things. You need to really think through, well, what is the narrative they're telling me and what stacks up and what doesn't? In other words, you need to do your due diligence. But that's not what's happening anymore. You listen to the analysts and you listen to what people are saying about these stocks, and it's all, this stock is doing this and it's going up because it's good, because they buy the narrative that Elon says that FSD is coming tomorrow. Netflix is going to expand its subscription base by selling into India. Wow, that's brilliant. That's 2 billion people who are going to buy Netflix. Yeah, they're going to pay a fraction of what you pay in your Netflix subscription. So, you know, the numbers, you got to really look behind them. And what I find incredible, I mean, Amazon's a great example, is if you take a look at the analyst recommendations, there are 59 analysts cover Amazon. How many of them have a sell recommendation? None. How many of them have a buy recommendation? All 59 of them. But none of them are looking at Amazon's moat. None of them are thinking about issues about where Amazon is getting in terms of its moat, in terms of defending its competitive moat. And I haven't seen anyone focus on the one of the really big issues for me is the management of any company. And you read through all the stories that came out in the last couple of months about the toxic culture that exists within Amazon, because there is an Amazon way of doing things. And if you are brought in as a very highly experienced guy to join Amazon because you've done so well in something else, you run into this barrier that the only way you're going to be able to bring your experience is if you do it in the Amazon way, you know, which kills the point of bringing people on board. And they're now going to really struggle to recruit because Amazon rewards people with stock options. And guess what? The stock's down about 20% this year, probably more, in fact, although it, you know, the numbers were good yesterday, but mainly because of Rivian. I think you probably, you know, I've over-labored this point, but you cannot get sucked into this argument that stocks and tech stocks will just go up forever. You actually have to do the due diligence and look behind what the market noise would like you to believe and really understand and forget FOMO and make decisions. The problem with that, though, is that I know I'm right about Tesla and it should only be probably 20% of its current value, but that's not the way the market votes. The market votes against me and I lose.
Yeah, very interesting points. Yeah, I actually believe on the cryptocurrencies that most of them will go away, and then many will actually be very regulated, out of existence, or outlawed altogether by government-based cryptocurrencies. I see the better way as being in these cryptocurrencies that are stable coins backed by some type of commodity or a security token that could, you know.
Well, I am absolutely fascinated by the technology, especially blockchain. And for years, I looked at the blockchain and really trying to understand what it actually is, and got some very interesting ideas together. And it struck me it was one of these classic solutions in search of a problem. Well, I really do think there are areas now where blockchain could potentially be fascinating and very useful. And one of these areas may be in the climate change sector, where we really need to create some kind of carbon emissions trading, where you can, you know, create offsets and then sell them as carbon credits. And we've been looking at that very closely. And one of the problems we've run into is how do you attach a real asset, such as a block of Brazilian forestry that is absorbing a carbon, how do you attach that to a tradable security, a digitally tradable security, because you then need to validate that underlying physical asset. You need to certify it exists. And then, because the idea would be you put that into this new crypto carbon credit market held on a blockchain, and then it becomes infinitely traded. And of course, you can then trace it back to the underlying carbon credit, you know, 1 ton of carbon, whatever it would be. But then you need all this, does the thing actually really exist? And I think that's one of the problems we really need to get our heads around when it comes to the whole idea of digital currencies, cryptocurrencies, however you want to define them, is how real can a non-real asset be? Mm-hmm. And I make the same arguments about NFTs. And again, I think an awful lot of it is people jumping on fashions.
Yeah, no, that's exactly. And also the whole legal infrastructure of that to be
infrastructure.
Yeah. There's a company we've been in discussions with that's based in Brazil that does that concept, Ethereum based 1 ton of carbon. They like the concept of the blockchain because you can sort of track and have that validity, basically documented in the blockchain of where the carbon's coming from, who's been involved with the projects. It's quite interesting, some emerging companies in that space. And just overall, relating to this environment discussion, you've written a lot on what you call militant ESG environment as the biggest threat to solving climate change. So can you elaborate on that?
This is all about consequences and understanding cause and effect. I want to be quite clear. I absolutely believe in the dangers of climate change. And I am very concerned about it, not just because I've got kids, but I generally want to get this sorted. And the thing is, we can do it. It can actually be done, but it needs to be done in a planned and thought out way. And there's a fantastic guy called Rob West, who runs a site called Thunderset Energy. He analyzes everything that's going on in climate change. And he's actually worked out we can get to carbon zero by continuing to do many of the things we're doing just now, like solar and wind. But if we are sensible about it and also do things like reforestation, improve soils, but also understand that there is a transition period, and during that transition period, let's move from coal and oil into gas, which is much less carbon emitting, polluting, and then gradually move out of gas into new technologies, then we'll be able to get to carbon zero by 2050. Fantastic, let's do it. Unfortunately, that's not the way it works, because what we've got is a very interesting situation where to build a wind farm in the North Sea off the northwest coast of Scotland, where I come from, you need something like 600 tons of steel. Now in the UK, we make our own steel or we import it from China. If we make our own steel, because we closed down all the coal mines, we have to import the metallurgical coal, which is a specialist coal, all the way from Australia, which creates enormous carbon miles. But that's what we do, and we make our own steel and we build this thing. Now, for the last 3 years, I've been trying to finance a new coal mine in the UK. Now, I know you're going to hold your hand up in horror and say, my God, how can this climate change denier be given a slot on my show? He's proposing mining coal. Well, I'm proposing mining metallurgical coal, because that means we'll be able to get our own coal in the UK directly down to the steel mills, where we'll build the steel to make wind farms in the North Sea. No, but that's not going to happen because nobody will fund it because it's coal. Why can't you fund it? Well, our board don't want us doing anything that's ESG non-compliant, which basically means we're not interested in the social and governance aspects of ESG. All we're interested in is the environment stuff, and you're proposing coal. Coal is bad. If we invest in it, we'll have lots of angry letters from investors and lots of very angry letters from greenies who will want to smash our windows and will hang effigies of us from gibbets. So it's not going to happen. And so it's become very quickly, it's changed the behavior of institutional investors who simply not look at anything that might be challenging. So that's one aspect of environmental, the environmental aspect of ESG, why it's a problem. You almost have this green Taliban that are stopping us plan a proper transition. Now that has massive, you're gonna find out that one of the key things I think about all the time is consequences. So let's just think out the consequences of 10 years of ESG, or basically environmentally based investment activism. Because what's happened is you've not been able to raise any money for oil and gas or coal in that space at all. The result is that we now face an enormous energy shortage, especially in Europe. Now, everyone knows about the Germans building the Nord Stream 2 pipeline to get gas from Russia. That's worked out well, hasn't it? But in the UK, we were just as daft because a key government minister decided not to bother maintaining the country's gas storage sites and told MPs, members of parliament, that we would save money by closing these sites down and just buying gas from the spot market, which worked even less well than trying to buy gas from the Russians. But the event, the net effect for Europe of not investing because of ESG in energy problems, in energy, in any kind of fossil energy, has been we now have an enormous energy insecurity crisis. And the result is that parts of Europe are now almost in bed with Russia. Look at the way the Germans are behaving, because they also made the lunatic decision to close down their nuclear power stations, and they fired up all their coal power stations as well, because they don't have any gas. The result is chronic instability. And that has an effect on alliances in geopolitical terms. Mm-hmm. If you look at the current situation, Americans broadly think the Europeans, especially the French, are betraying them to Russia because of this energy insecurity. Of course, the Europeans will counter, well, hang on, you inflicted Trump on us. Look what he said about us. So, you know, that alliance is probably toast anyway. But, you know, it's energy, which we're short of, is a result of bad investment decisions that are basically underlying this saber rattling over Ukraine. We have chronic instability as a result. And then there is the distortion effect of where we've been investing all the money that hasn't gone into coal and oil and gas, but into renewable power. And most of it's gone into things like wind farms, because everybody wants to say that they are making green investments. So instead of risky wind farms yielding 5 to 7%, they yield almost nothing, because everyone wants to own a wind farm. But what we're discovering about wind farms is quite scary. Now they do work, but they're not nearly as reliable as people thought they were. In the UK, we've discovered that the maintenance costs are a hell of a lot higher than we thought. And one of the key things with this offshore wind power is if they go wrong, all you can do is switch them off, because there's a shortage of maintenance crews and vessels that could take the crews out there to fix them. And the final nail in wind's coffin is a long-term weather study in the UK has shown that the speed of the wind has fallen by nearly 15% over the last 50 years. A lot of that due to the increased friction that building buildings and, guess what, wind farms creates in our wind. And what we've seen is we either get very little wind, or we get wind that is too strong for the wind farms to handle. But we've still invested all this money in wind rather than investing it in really good new technologies like tide, every day the tide comes in and out basically twice. And so it's utterly predictable what the flows are going to be. But there's been very little real investment into tidal energy because it looks more expensive and more difficult to do than wind. So we are chasing this wind thing. And then people are saying, oh, we can do even more wind if we build enormous floating platforms. And you're just spending more money on doing the same thing and not getting the same returns you expected. So this environmental Taliban-esque approach to climate change investment, it's got to change, and we have to get a real proper transition strategy in place. But it ain't going to happen if investors are just going to submit to environmental pressure. I wish I saw investors spending as much time thinking about the social aspects of investments, where I reckon income inequality is going to floor us all very shortly unless we address it better, and especially issues like corporate governance, which gets almost zero attention because everyone's only focused on the environment aspects.
Right.
So yeah, that probably gives you a good idea of where I stand in ESG. I believe in ESG, but I want it done properly, not in the kind of selective, scared way that it's being done just now.
Yeah, absolutely agree. And yeah, a lot of people are not aware of all the inputs into the equation, or the overall equation. So, I mean, look at solar, all of the greenhouse gases associated with the mining and milling operations to make the panel, you know, are not generally included. And if we were to go to any significant level of solar, that could create massive greenhouse gases. You know,
And your Tesla doesn't become carbon neutral until you've done 500,000 miles in it, by which time the battery needs to be replaced anyway.
Yeah.
In which case you start again with a massive carbon. You know, it's all bollocks at the end of the day.
Yeah. And also there's been, like recently with Royal Dutch Shell, activist investors trying to split the company into two, one renewable company, one legacy company. But as they mentioned, we require the revenues from the legacy part of the company to finance, you know, development into the renewable part. If we were to split into two companies, we wouldn't have any you know, investment in that. So that's
Let me just give you another real world example of, you know, what could happen with a well-planned transition and building in the social and governance side of ESG. I mean, we're looking at making a petrochemicals plant, building a petrochemicals plant. The reason we want to do that is because even though by 2050 we're not going to need oil and oil is going to, you know, decline, all the things that you make with oil, plastics, adhesives, false rubbers, all these things, we're still going to need them for a growing global economy. If we don't have oil to make everything, I mean, everything I'm wearing today has got elements of oil, petrochemicals in it. Yeah. And if we don't make these things, the global economy stops completely. So we're going to build a plant to make sure the growth continues. Now, that's very important because where we're going to build this plant has a massive economic problem, which is their population is still expanding. It is a stable economy, but they need to create jobs and growth so they can provide for new workers coming into the workforce. And they want to raise what we call the human capital of their population. It's a key social thing that we create jobs and create industries that will have multiplier effects. So one of the key things we're building into this plan is that alongside our petrochemicals manufacturing, we will have treatment centers to recycle plastics, which can be fed into the process. So we're thinking green about the whole thing, and we're thinking environment. And we reckon that by building new industries like recycling, you're going to create even more jobs, because there's this great thing called the multiplier effect. If you give you create one job, you probably create three or four other jobs servicing that one job. So that's what we're going to do. But as soon as we show Western investors this deal, they turn around and they say, oh, petrochemical can't do anything with petrols. No, no, definitely not. And then you explain social aspects. Yeah, that's all very good, you know, trying to, you know, save millions of people from penury, but yeah, we still can't do it because, you know, it's petrochemical. Come on, it's petrochemical. Don't be daft. I'm not going to embarrass myself in the, you know, the allocations committee by trying to invest in petrochemicals. Yeah. You want to end my job?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Wow. Yeah, and fascinating discussion. Just a last question on your thoughts of what makes sense in this environment in terms of investment classes from a generic perspective. What are your thoughts, for this year going out 6 to 12 months?
My very quick prediction on the market is that we're going to see some kind of economic recovery kicking in now that the pandemic seems finally under control. But it's going to be, I reckon, some kind of just one more uptick before reality kicks in. So although I think there's one more leg up for stocks, after that, we're going to see at best pretty flatlining. And that means you need to be really clever and selective in the stocks you pick. It's like doing this due diligence and understanding the underlying narrative and the company in detail. But I would still favor stocks, especially over bonds, because I reckon there is, you know, as the world normalizes, bonds are going to come off. They're going to come off big time. And unless you are happy getting paid the square root of zero as a yield on a bond long term, because you won't be able to sell the bond, then I'd stick away from the bond markets. But you know what? Every single institutional investor would say, I need to buy bonds because that's the way that our asset liability matching works. So I'd favor good, strong, fundamental stocks. But I'd also get set for a couple of perhaps what we call no-see-ums, you know, sudden shocks. And a lot of them tend to be utterly predictable with hindsight. Geopolitics is a risk, but I think it's more of a long-term pestering sore. I really don't think there's going to be a war in Ukraine because it actually plays into Russia and China's benefit to just keep up the pressure as it is, because it's making the West look unconnected and disjointed. So the longer they do that, the better. And you just got to get used to the fact that it's going to be a tension. If I have a big sell for this year, it's probably Europe. I'm really concerned about the fragility of the European Union, because Germany's new government is a three parties in a very uneasy alliance, and for them to change is very, very tough. And of course, one of the key parts of the Greens, who are holding back climate transition, and you know, they're one of the major reasons that Germany seems disengaged from the rest of Europe. If we start to see big European inflation, which we got yesterday, rates are going to have to rise. The Germans will insist on it. If rates rise, countries like especially Italy, but also Spain and Greece again, are really going to struggle. And at that point, I think we get a renewed sovereign debt crisis, or you know, some form of ECB-imposed austerity causing backlashes in countries like Italy, which could end up in a Italian exit or something like that. As for the UK, because people always end up asking me, what do I think of the UK? I mean, I've given up reading about Boris Johnson. He's even more embarrassing than Donald Trump must have been to most Americans. Okay. And it's crazy that in some of the most difficult markets of all time that require serious grown-up thinking, the key concern of UK politicians seems to be to stop Boris having his cake or eating it. Sometimes I'm glad I'm here in Dubai at the moment.
Wow, very interesting. And how can our listeners learn more about your work in terms of where to go?
Yeah. You know, I do think I'm kind of unique in that I write this blog called Morning Porridge. You can find it on www.morningporridge.com. It's also out there on LinkedIn, and Zero Hedge usually picks it up for some reason as well. That's what I do every morning. And it started about 15 years ago because I thought, I need something to talk to my clients about every day. So I wrote The Porridge for them, and it's gradually expanded to about 12,000 subscriptions now. You can get it delivered to you for a mere tenner a week, a month, and you get it delivered every morning, or you can just read it for free on the website. But the rest of the time, I'm actually properly working, doing what I call my day job, which is making private debt and equity investments and strategizing on behalf of Shard Capital, my firm, where we're very active and expanding from London into other parts of the universe. That's the real universe rather than the imagined metaverse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Well, thank you so much, Bill. It's been a very interesting, insightful discussion. Thank you.
Good. Glad you enjoyed it.
Great. Well.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.